What is up, everyone? This is Luke Lintz, one of your hosts of the High Key Podcast. And today we have an in-person guest in Puerto Rico. His name is Greg Batista, and he's a new friend of mine. And this is going to be a really good conversation. He is the owner of G. Batista Engineering Construction, a business that has been running since 2000, literally over 20 years now. And so we're going to get into entrepreneurship, mindset, growing a business from basically right out of university, and a lot more today. So Greg, what I want to do is I want to start with the one thing that we were talking about just outside of the show, where you said you always knew you were going to be a millionaire. You were that kid. just walking around and just saying, I'm going to make it. And so, like, where did that come from?
To be honest with you, I have no idea. You know, I grew up in a, you know, middle, low income neighborhood where, you know, you had all the kids out in the street playing, and everybody was on the same thing when they were playing basketball and just doing their thing. And I was like, I always had this mindset of, I am destined for great things, you know. and throughout history, you know, you have, like, you know, Alexander the Great and these people, and you read about these things in the book. But this was something that I never really, it was something that was just inside of me. I can't explain it. The best way that I can explain it, you're probably going to laugh at this, is that I don't know if you know who Mr. Rogers is. No, he doesn't know Mr. Rogers.
I don't know Mr.
Most
Rogers.
Most of your 40s and your 50-year-olds are going to say, oh, Mr. Rogers. He's a character, like a fictional character, where he would go into his house and he would have these puppets, really mild-mannered kind of person. He would teach children the alphabet, you know, something like Sesame Street, right? But he would always say in his show, he would go on and on saying in his show that, you are special. You are destined for great things. You see yourself as different from other people, but that's a good thing. You know, he would have that. And I would watch him religiously. That was like my favorite TV show as a kid. And I think some of that thing stuck. And I know that it stuck up until my adulthood, because I was watching, they just made a documentary out of him. And I was crying during the documentary because it stuck so much with me. So if I say anything came out of that, is I had that thing from childhood, and it came from anywhere, be from Mr. Rogers.
So Greg, if we rewind all the way back, at the age of 7, I was told that at the age of 7, show me a man and I'll show you who he's going to become. And so at the age of 7, what did you want to become?
My mom, she bought me, when I was a kid, I was in the fourth grade. If you're 7 at the fourth grade, she bought me these things called Lincoln Logs. Before Legos, because Legos is like high tech, you know? And that Legos hadn't been invented yet. There was these little logs that you would put together. Again, your 40 and your 50-year-olds are going to be like, yeah, I know these Lincoln Logs. So I would put these Lincoln Logs together, and I slept with them, and I had them next to my bed, and I would build these really cool things out of these Lincoln Logs. So yes, if it was, and I would be, I still am a very creative person. And thanks to my mother, who saw that, you know, at a very early age, that I had that thing inside of me. She would buy me paint stuff. She would buy me things that I can build on. She bought me these little sticks that you can build stuff with. And that was that little spark. And sometimes parents, and as a parent, you know, it's important for you to, if you see that your child has a proclivity to read or to have music or whatever that is, feed it to that. be able to accommodate that in your child's life. It is so important. It's so important when a kid is developing that to be able to nurture that.
Amazing. Dude, I just thought about it right now. Happy Father's Day.
Hey.
It's literally Father's Day.
Thank you.
Kids. That's amazing. So did you take that in terms of like the good aspects of the parenting that you had into you being a father and into your parenthood with your kids?
Yes and no. I come from an incredible family. We're so together, even to this day. We're extremely family oriented. But like every other family, we all have our problems. You know, my mother, who, by the way, I think she's the most successful person that I know. And she doesn't have a whole lot of money, but success to her is being happy. She came from a broken home and she wanted to have children. And she wanted to have four children. She wanted them to be healthy. You know, so right now I've got my own business. My other sister, she is a professor at a prestigious college. My other sister, she's a principal at a huge school in Texas. And my other brother, he's like a head of an agency. And her grandchildren, she's got three engineers. She's got one that works for Apple as an Apple engineer working at the Apple Park, NFL player. I mean, So yes, I don't know how that answers your question, but it came up to me that you know, success is all in your head. And I just think of my mother and how she brought us up, and that she's the most successful person I know, because she's basically happy. So I digressed. I digressed big time, but I was just had that thing of that picture of my mother in my head. So what was the original question?
No, dude, that was good. That was good. In terms of like, I resonate with that a lot where I think, especially with social media and stuff, people throw around these really flashy words of success, like, and directly correlating it with making money and making all these successful things where like, we're not defining the terms that we're using in everyday life. Like, everybody has their own definition of success. Success doesn't have a standard definition across every single person. Success to one person isn't success to another person.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely,
it's very custom to that person's life. Would you say that you're successful right now, Greg? Would you consider yourself successful?
That's a good one. And I'll say it, it's not that I hesitate to answer it. Because the thing is that as you grow older, you're you know, to one person, it means something, but to one person at a certain stage in your life, it means something. To me, I had, when I was in college and in high school, I had pictures of Lamborghinis on my wall. And I said, I'm going to buy me a Countach. The Countach with the old version, you know? And to me, that was success. And I went, about a year and a half ago, I went with my girlfriend to a dealer and I actually wanted to buy one. And I got into the car. I was there for like a minute and I said, this is not going to make me happy. So literally we said, let's go. We just walked out and left. And now I have my Jeep, the one that they stole from here. Actually bought me another one. I said, I'm going to drive around my Jeep. But the original question was about success and how different people see success.
I think there's a great lesson in this though, and I want you to dive deeper into it because
or am I successful?
But I want the audience to have a great takeaway from this because like I said, a lot of the audience is definitely like high school people, mainly lost. And what you just said there is something really good where you had your success tied to materialistic things. And then once you actually got to the point of being able to purchase something, it wasn't even there in terms of you having the realization that this isn't going to make me happy and a version of success. Mm-hmm. And so what would you say for other people out there who have like these ideas of very materialistic things, very flashy cars, jewelry, lots of money, and tying that to success and therefore tying that to their happiness? Like, what do you think?
Yeah, I can say things like, oh, don't be materialistic or whatever, but that's not going to work in just telling somebody. Yeah. That is a very personal, it's a very personal voyage that a person has to take, right? For them to define ultimately with, you know, their wisest version of themselves to realize what that is. Now, you know, when I wanted that Lamborghini, I was in that mindset. And that, thank God I had that because that's what drove me to, you know, I want to be a millionaire since I was a kid. That's what drove me. So, you know, at the ripe old age of 50, I had everything. I had everything I wanted. I had the health, the people, the community around me. I had the houses, the cars. And what I was missing was, you know, I wanted to have like love in my life and have, you know, certain type of relationships. So, you know, I was telling you about this a little, you know, a little when we were outside that, you know, when I left Puerto Rico, I actually, you know, left my family, left my wife after 30 years. And I was in search for that love, which, you know, to a certain point, I had become this, what many people would call a narcissist. You know, I built this bubble, right? And I was proud to have everybody living in this bubble and depending on me. And I actually liked that, you know, because you build this world to your likeness and you're taking care of everybody and everybody's good. And, but you sort of, in a sense, I found out that you sort of forget about yourself. And I think this resonates with a lot of people because when you have that goal, when you're laser focused on something, you tend to lose a little bit about yourself. Mm. And, you know, I have to give a lot of credit to my girlfriend who's here right now, where, you know, she's a therapist, and, you know, she helps a lot of people out. And, you know, I've been struggling with that version of myself, and I found that it's sort of progressed from the material stuff and to what in my mind was success. And, you know, people talking about me and having, I used to throw these huge parties with celebrities and stuff like that. And I used to think that was important. So
that sounds like what we did.
So, you know, you're a young dude. You have a lot of crap to go through. You have a lot of shit to go through, a lot of mountains to climb. You're a very precocious guy, and you're smart, you're intelligent, and, you know, you've got that wisdom, and I can see it in you, right? But you've got a long way to go. And you know, maybe you might be, you know, partying until you're 80 years old, and that makes you, if that your definition of success and being happy, then, you know, more power to your motherfucking ass, you know. But my journey has been one where I have shifted from more of the material things, more of the professional success, to being more relationship based. And to go from that mindset to this mindset of, you know, thinking other people before you, of thinking that, you know, people need, you know, nurturing, to be more empathetic, be more vulnerable. Those two words for me were not in my lexicon, you know, several years ago. I had to go through major pain. And we're going through it, you know, I'm going through that now because it's a shift. And it's a shift that as the more that I go through it, the more I'm happier with myself. Because the more I'm happier with myself and I see that I'm being happy, the more it translates to the people around me, to my girlfriend, to my daughters, which, you know, when I was young, I still feel guilty that I was working all these hours and wasn't with them, you know? And it makes me really proud that I'm at a point right now that I have, you know, a circle of people that support me, that see my struggle and have the patience to deal with that stuff. And, you know, I was at the airport ready to come here. This was the day before yesterday, to come here to Puerto Rico. And I was telling my girlfriend this. I was, there's, you know, a few stories like this, but this is one that just comes out to me. I was working on my computer, getting ready at the gate, and there's a guy sitting next to me, and he was talking about how his brother died, and he was going to Puerto Rico to be with his mom because his brother died. And they just told him like the night before. So he got on the first plane and he was saying that he worked at the airport, and it was so ironic that the plane that he was going to be working on is the same plane that he's taking now to see his brother. And I started crying. I started crying because of, you know, I was thinking of my brother, my relationships, and man, this can happen to anybody. And I told myself, as soon as he hangs up, I'm just going to go over and, you know, tell the guy, look, you know, be strong and give him a hug or something. But a few years before that, I was the most, like, somebody would tell me, oh, my mom died. Oh, okay, you know, let's go to lunch. You know, it's a completely different mindset. And like, again, I'm happy that that's happening, but it's such a struggle. And I guess I'm the kind of person that's built to take challenges. I love challenges. I love difficult things. I love hard things. And thank God I'm built like that, because, you know, any other person would probably be on Prozac right now. Yeah. You know? So, yeah.
Dude, we have so many things you're going to get into from this. Thank you for sharing all of that. I appreciate it. Wow, dude, that's crazy. I'm extremely intrigued about the aspect of It sounds like before making that transition in terms of your mindset and in terms of like what you value in life, you were extremely business oriented and everything was just about business and making more money, mm-hmm. putting in the hours. You said before that it was very normal and like very standard, putting in 70, 80 hour weeks, which is, you know, double the average full-time.
Yeah. And I used to be on vacations with my family and it's happened. A client calls, I said, I'm getting on a plane. I'm leaving.
Oh, like, no way.
It was at that point. And me looking back, it just makes me sad. You know, right now I'm like, and I have this guilty feeling. And at nighttime, sometimes when I have my, you know, private conversations with her, she says, Greg, you don't beat yourself up. It's part of, you know, what happens in life. We're always in transition. We're always trying to be a better person. We're always trying to seek that happiness. And however that happens, you know, you shouldn't just, you know, beat yourself up because of these things.
So my biggest question is, during those like key times, like thinking back on, and I assume you've done a ton of reflection to get to that transition point. So when reflecting back on it, during those times of, say, your family trips where a client calls and you have to leave like right then, what made you do that? Like, was it the money? Was it the fear of losing everything? Was it the distraction of being away from your family? What was it?
That's a really good question. I think without trying to think about it too much, I have a, you know, from a young age, like we got, you know, I had a girlfriend in college and we got married in college because, you know, we got pregnant and I was one of these guys, one of these party animals and, you know, the crazy dude. But you know, from the time that we got pregnant, all of a sudden it was a weight on me because all of a sudden you're going to be a family man in 9 months. What are you going to do? When you establish a business, you have employees that I care for, that, you know, somebody buys a house or somebody's got a kid that I feel responsible for these people. And if there's, and, you know, apart from the drive, apart from me wanting to keep my clients happy, you know, because that's what a businessman does, there's that part also that I owe as a protector, as a person who wants to maintain this bubble so that everybody's safe inside of it. Part of that is that because the people that called me was like at that time my biggest client is like one of the top architects in South Florida. That I can't lose that client.
Yeah.
If I lose that client, my business is going to be in trouble. So I better, you know, I told them, you know, look, this is what I do for you. This is what I do for you. And they would consider that. And then they would, you know, keep giving me contracts.
Wow. So it got to the point of where you had that feeling. I feel like you were conceptualizing your thoughts, like as you're talking. And so mm-hmm. like, I feel that it was, I'm trying to relate this to like our business and like how I feel at certain times in terms of like we have over 75 full-time team members and it's like I'm young and that's a lot of what you said, like mouths to feed where it's much more than just me and myself. Like when we started the business, it was just me. And so it was easy to think about like failing and stuff. Where I'm like, okay, no skin off my back. You know, worst case scenario, I just had a great learning experience, but it's not like that anymore. It's where it's much bigger than just yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's what you said, huge weight on your shoulders. That's crazy. I want to get into the part of outside of university. So you had a kid at a very young age. Yes. in university.
Yes.
And then you went to go work at you had a job for 10 years outside of university. Is that right?
Yes. I went to work for a company called Turner Construction. At that time was the largest construction company in the world.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. And so after 10 years, you transitioned into opening up your own business and you had like a flipping point there. What was the reason it took you 10 years to get to the point of transitioning into opening up your own business?
Well, there's different industries where it takes... There's different industries that you have to pay your dues to certain degrees, okay? If you're a, like, Bitcoin guys, there's a lot of Bitcoin millionaires out there, right? And tons. And it's, I'm not saying that they're not doable. This is a capitalistic society. And if you took the risk of spending $1,000 and you took the risk of putting $1,000 in Bitcoin at the right time, you're gonna be a millionaire. That's how this nation was built, in taking these risks. And if you have that money, that's great. But the point I'm trying to make is that person who put the $1,000, you know, he could have been a middle school kid that got $1,000 gift from it. Oh, put it in there. Didn't need any kind of like experience and education and things like of that sort. He just made it. That's diametrically opposed to, for example, you have an industry like construction and engineering. For somebody to make it in this industry, you have to have 20, 30 years of experience. You never hear of a kid, 20-year-old kid that's got a big construction and engineering business, you know, and is very well thought of and is held in high esteem by his peers. It just doesn't exist. You see? So I knew from the very beginning that it's something that I had to pay my dues. And I paid my dues by working these long hours. And I knew that I can cram as much experience as I could into 1 year's time. So when I worked 80 hours a week in one year, I would have 2-3 times the experience of, you know, somebody else that didn't work as much. So when I transitioned from construction into engineering, I did exactly the same thing. So, you know, I'm 55 right now. And I have so much experience crammed into my brain right now, and knowledge, and just being, you know, the ups and downs, and, you know, getting into problems and failing, you know, and being to get out of it. That in this industry, I'm at the point right now where I'm at the height of my superpowers right now, that I'm able to hire somebody like you guys, right? That's going to leverage that brand that I've been developing as a know-it-all in construction engineering for 30 years, that you guys can bring that message out to the masses.
100%. So with what you went into, did you like what you went into in terms of outside of university? Did you like that job that you had?
I friggin' loved it.
Oh, wow.
I loved it. And that's one of the things that I feel so lucky that, you know, and I'm going back to the time when I was doing my Lincoln logs, you know, and I had, when I was doing my Lincoln logs, I didn't have an, I had no idea as a kid that people actually made money doing this. And then, you know, at the scale that, you know, some of these buildings are done and how they're built and how things are put together, you know, I'm a very curious person. And I said, how do they do these things? And be able to have that knowledge in me at a world-class level.
What would your suggestion be for, like, you loved what you did, and it seems like it was on that path since you were young, seven with the Lincoln Logs, and then you carried it forward right into your business with putting in the hours and putting in the work. This isn't the case for, I would say, 99% of people out there. Like, I know firsthand in terms of I'm fresh out of where a lot of my friends, you know, have been graduating university over the past like 4 years, and I've seen their progression of all the way through high school, through university. Well, I don't really have a friend group anymore there. I keep my friend group very tight, but acquaintances back at home, and I've seen the way they progressed. And I think a lot of people in high school, university are lost in more ways than one.
Yes.
And one of the things is just not knowing what they're going to be passionate about and not knowing what they want to do. Do you have any advice for like someone who's in high school, someone who's in university, who maybe is a hard worker, but just isn't really liking what they're doing, say in university, and like what they should do, like to try new things out?
I absolutely have some advice. And this is the same advice that I give my daughters. I have a 31-year-old daughter and a 19-year-old daughter. And they're smart, independent, incredible young ladies. There's just, I wish I could talk about them and blab about them more, but they're just incredible human beings. And I would tell them, look, you know, I own 100% of my business. If you like engineering or whatever, then come on over. But if you don't like it, if you don't like it, because they used to work for Summers and stuff like that. If you don't like it, I don't want you. I really don't want you. I want you to chase what you're passionate about. And my daughter, you know, she was in high school, and I said, what do you love? What are you passionate about? Oh, I love English. Like reading English lit. I said, then be the best English lit person that you can be. Like, really? No, but why can't I get a job? He said, just forget it. That's secondary. If you are the best, you're going to make money and you're going to be able to support yourself if you're the best at something. And to be the best at something, you have to have that passion. That is such an incredibly important ingredient. So she went to college. She actually got a double degree in economics and in English lit. She said, what can I do now? We had some political contacts. She worked for some, you know, politicians and stuff like that, and wasn't getting anywhere. She said, just keep pushing, baby. Just keep pushing. She also wanted to be a lawyer, you know, but then she was able to get a position in a bank on K Street in Washington, D.C. You know, K Street is like the economic center of Washington, D.C. So she was able to get into the bank. She loved politics. So before you know it, she was handling Hillary Clinton's 2016 account at a very young age, handling millions and millions of dollars in this bank. So she grew in the bank. Now she's a VP at the bank right now. She's 31 years old. And then 3 years ago, she decided, I want to be a lawyer. And she graduated. I went to her graduation a couple of months ago. Now she's a lawyer.
No way.
So the biggest thing is that she is just a go-getter, and she was just following her passion. They brought her from this English lit degree that she thought she couldn't do anything about, but because of the passion that she showed, it brought her to that point where she is now. And now that the counsel, the lawyers that are the lawyers for the bank, knew she graduated from college, and before she gets her lawyer's license, they've hired her, and she's moving to New York this Saturday, making a ton of money. But you know, I'm saying this because it all started with the spark of going after your passion, right? And once you develop yourself, once the years go by, you know, you go 18, you're 19 years old, you're 20, you're 25. You start to meet more people out in the industry, and you get to develop that sense of passion, of what you're really passionate about. Maybe 1 year you didn't know what crypto was, and then somebody told you, hey, crypto is this, and you said, oh my God, I can do all these Excel spreadsheets and do all these analytics, and they love that. And that's how you develop that, but you didn't know that a few years ago. So as years go by, you develop that stuff. My younger daughter, she's 19, and she goes to Florida New College. And for those of you who aren't keeping up with this whole Trump, DeSantis clash that's happening right now, there's in Florida New College is a very liberal college. It's a state college, a liberal college. So DeSantis is a Republican. And what he did was he doesn't like the liberals, the liberal arts. He doesn't want anybody to say gay. There's this whole national news going on about teaching kids in college about these sexual orientation. My daughter, my 19-year-old daughter, she's gay. And she's very involved with this whole, and she's, you know, she's gone on protest against the DeSantis, because DeSantis came in and took the whole board of trustees and got rid of them. And he put in there conservatives. So what they're doing right now is they're in the middle of this transition where it's not going to be a liberal arts college anymore. They're going to turn it into one of these church conservative colleges. And the professors are dropping. Two-thirds of the professors are dropping out. It's a whole thing. It's those of you who are reading the news and know about this stuff, she's in the middle of it. So I told my daughter, go for it. She's seen me in like doing these protests and being politically involved. And I feel so proud of her, because now she's following her passion, which is protesting and going, you know, doing things that are in her mind very important to her, which is LGBTQ rights, which is, you know, the solving the green. She takes it very serious, this whole thing about the greenhouse gases and global warming and things of that nature, and that's very that's important for her, and she's passionate about it. And I had lunch with her the other day. I said, look, I think you're going to end up being one of these, you know, people that's going to be, you know, one of these protest people, or can become, you know, politically involved, that you know, that are doing their thing and expressing their passion through, you know, protests or being politically active.
That's amazing. I liked a lot of things that you said. One thing that I really liked is the aspect of whatever you do. Like, you basically explained how you're fine with anybody doing anything, just whatever you do, be the best at, and how you think that the only way people can be the best at something is if they're truly passionate about something. And so go into your passion and just become the best at it. I think that's amazing advice for anybody out there. One thing, a branch off of that, is I think that your daughter, who's 31, sounds like an absolute anomaly in terms of like like how amazing she is in terms of going into multiple fields and having success in multiple fields. I think that on the contrary of going into your passion, especially with like social media and really unlimited opportunities with the digital era, I think people can go down a rabbit hole of not being focused in one thing. And I think you probably know better than 99% of people in terms of putting in the work in your one industry of like how beneficial being focused is on one specific industry over a long enough time horizon. And so what would you say the comparison between going into your passion, but your passion can change, with being focused on one thing for an extended period of time to be extremely good and really become the best at that one thing?
I don't know whether it's luck or what, because, you know, people change. I am certainly not the same person I was 5 years ago. I'm certainly not the same person I was 20 years ago. And, you know, one day I might wake up tomorrow and said, fuck this engineering stuff. I'm gonna dedicate full time to painting. I just built an art studio in my office building, and you know, I paint celebrities and I do all, they have them, you know, autograph them for me. That's passionate for me. Maybe I wanna go ahead and do that. But I consider myself lucky that I'm able since the little Lincoln Log kid, for that to not change and sort of like be constant, right? It's gone from making money, that I've made good money doing this, to actually helping people. Because after the Champlain Towers collapse in South Florida that killed 98 people 2 years ago, I found something in me that I can use my craft, that I can use my experience to help people. I actually wrote a book. 100% of the proceeds goes to the Red Cross and to educate people. And, you know, ever since then, I've been helping, like the government establish these laws that have changed that, you know, I've done a lot of good recommendations in my book, which many have been taken to help people. I've also, you know, I'm in the middle of making webinars and classes online where, you know, in people that are in the right positions, such as property managers, such as board members and building engineers, that they can take advantage of this education. So it's sort of shifted from, you know, making money, but using that same passion in a different light, which is what I consider now very important, which is helping people. And, you know, I've always loved helping people, but it's sort of a different type of aspect. And I love what, like, for example, what my girlfriend does. She's a therapist and she helps people. I think it's so, you know, I forget the word. Humbling. It's humbling, and it's so great. The word just escapes me because it transcends being happy. It's just, if you're a person that likes to give, I consider myself a giver to the point where people say, Greg, you're an idiot. Why are you giving so much of that? I said, no, it makes me feel good. It does. It makes me feel good. And when that when giving has to do with the stuff, the thing that you love to do, that's sort of a different dimension. So yeah, it's gone from making money to helping people, but all along that route, it's the passion for building and engineering. And a lot of people, you know, they change. Sometimes, you know, halfway through they said, no, I don't like engineering. I don't like construction. And they might change to do something else. That's their path. But I feel, you know, I have a lot of gratitude to God or whoever's out there that it's taken me through this, you know, through this journey where I've maintained myself in this industry.
If you look through your entire journey, like all the way from the beginning, like university, having the job for 10 years, starting up your business, and then switching your mindset now and being kind of on a different wavelength, where would you say that you were the happiest?
I've always been a happy person. I've always been a happy person. And happiness is basically a state of mind, right? Another person in my same shoes, having walked exactly the same path as me, might shoot themselves in the face. Like, really, because I've been through some shit, as I'm sure a lot of people have. But it's a state of mind. And, you know, one of the things that I sort of picture myself is, look, I'm healthy. The people around me are healthy. The people I love are with me. You know, let's just start from that. You know, I have enough money that I can, you know, go on vacations and do everything I want that I've dreamed of. I've lost my train of thought.
It was the happiness throughout all of life. Okay. And then you've always been happy. I've always been happy too. I still have long life to live.
I can see the energy coming from you. But it's a state of mind. Yeah. And you know what I think is that, man, I could have been born in Somalia in the 80s. I could have been born in the caveman days where everybody was scared of you know, saber-toothed tigers coming in and eating them. You know, we're so lucky to be living in the United States of America, you know, at a point where, you know, despite all the worldwide problems there are, we're living in a standard living where we have health care, that we've got, you know, all this stuff that we've got around us. That many people, if you don't have a historical, deep historical perspective of what's happened to mankind throughout, you know, humankind's history, you'll know that we're living in an area that we're so lucky to be alive now and be at the top of our game here. So just starting from that, I feel like I'm lucky. And if I have enough to help people, then, you know, so be it. So, you know, just taking it from there, yes. But everybody's got struggles. You can be the happiest person in the world, but you're still going to have struggles. And if you don't have struggles, that's because you're probably playing video games all day and not doing anything with your life and not taking any risks. So yes, and again, it goes back to me being a person that enjoys challenges and enjoys doing hard things. And somebody says, no, you can't do that. What? I'm going to go over there and do it. I might fail, but I love the journey of getting these things done. And that in of itself makes me happy. So it's the complete package. So to answer your question, yes, I'm very happy.
That's super cool, man. That's super cool. In terms of going to starting up the business and getting into the business, what was it like starting? Like, my main question is, like, you had a family at this point. Like, you had a kid now that was, what, 10 years old? Like, 11 years old?
Yes.
And you took, like, I'm a big believer in how we start up our business is, I started up the business in high school. And so on my social media platform, I'm talking all the time to people who are my age in high school and in university. And I'm like, listen, the time to take the risk is right now. The time to take the risk is when you're young, when you don't have a house to feed, when you don't have a family, when you can live in your parents' basement, when you have no overhead costs. Like, it's the best time to take the risk of at all. Like, any single person Absolutely. Listening to this podcast that's in high school or university, take the biggest risk, the most outlandish risk. Like, the worst that could happen is that you go a little bit in debt, or you go really big in debt and you go bankrupt, which isn't even that bad if you're in your young 20s. And so that's how how I always thought about things, is that I could miserably fail for the next 10 years and still be all right, because I'd be like 26, 28. Mm-hmm. And so my main thing is, you had kids and you left your job and started up a business. And so what was that like in terms of taking a risk when you did have a house to feed?
I was scared shitless. And you know, I was scared shitless when my girlfriend told me that she was pregnant. And I was scared shitless when I went up to her father and told her, look, you know, we're going to get married. I was scared shitless when I was going to start my business. I was scared shitless when I, you know, left the family to come to search for myself. You know, I'm scared shitless when, you know, starting a new relationship, you know, so what's going to happen? You know, the life is full of being scared shitless, and it's how you manage. And it's how you manage that frightness inside of you, that scared thing inside of you. And I've always said that you have to be willing to take risks. And if you don't take risks, and I sometimes say, you know, if you don't, a person who risks nothing, does nothing, has nothing, and is nothing, right? And I've always, I've sort of seen it that way. And it's a risk. And even if you have a kid, and, you know, thank God I had some money in the bank. But, you know, when you have a six-figure salary and you got a family and you're starting a business and you don't know how, like, your two-month projection is, I don't know. What's my two-month projection? A big old question mark. And that was before the internet, okay? That was before the internet became a big thing, where it's Google and none of that existed. I had to actually like go to the yellow pages and put ads in the paper. Oh, engineer for hire.
Yeah, back in 2000.
In 2000, the Google was nothing like it was, like we have AdWords and all these other things. It wasn't like that. I was actually searching for, I actually had to put snipe. I remember putting signs up in neighborhoods, you know, and getting in trouble with the building department, saying you're gonna get fined for putting signs up. And so I had to advertise, and I was like, yeah, you're gonna come pick them up. Yeah, I'm gonna come pick them up. I didn't pick anything up. Thank God, I never, you know, they never sent me to jail or got fined or anything. Oh. But it's, you know, you have to. It's risk. It's risk.
We're up 44. Cool. One thing that you said there about taking risks, and if you don't take risks, you're never going to achieve like anything great. I think people have a misconception nowadays when people get too overwhelmed or like too overly stressed, and they think that nobody else has been in that place before, and they go in an opposite direction of, instead of figuring out how to deal with that certain problem and dealing with that new level of stress, that new level of problems, that new level of problem solving, they go in the opposite direction of being like, I need to figure out ways to completely avoid this. And I think it's the wrong mindset of where you're never going to avoid problems in your life. And no matter where you're at, even if you're poor, extremely rich, no matter what level you're at, no matter what age, you're always going to have an unbelievable amount of problems in different areas of your life. And those areas of life change. And it's just about how you manage those problems. And as you grow and as you age, becoming better at managing those problems. And as you manage bigger problems, continuing to be able to effectively manage those problems. Would you say that that's accurate?
Well, it's not just managing the problems. It's managing your state of mind, because you're the ultimate problem solver, right? I'm the kind of person that when I have a problem, I think of plan A, plan B, plan C to how to avoid these things. And trust me, man, in my business, I am confronted with lots of problems. And if I were to put energy into, oh my God, what's going to happen, which we're human, that's a natural tendency. But when you're in a certain position, you have to educate yourself to not let that adversely affect you, that, you know, so you can keep going. And to me, that's been something that's one of these survival mechanisms that I've been able to develop, you know, through the years. Because if I didn't have that mechanism where I can handle the stress, the inevitable stress that comes with taking risks, that comes with trying to, you know, get ahead, I'd be in a crazy home.
Yeah. Did you have any extreme failures at the beginning of the business?
What's extreme?
Like anything that was like close to putting you completely out of business?
No. The closest that came was in the downturn of 2007, 2008.
Yeah.
I had about 30 employees and it got down to like 5 employees.
No.
And there's a mistake that I made that was I wanted so bad to make it. I stopped taking a salary for myself and I paid my people, and I paid people for a lot longer than I should have, because it pained me to have to like get rid of people because I just didn't have the work. I have no problem firing people that are incompetent or do something wrong or whatever, but that those kind of things really affect me. So I wouldn't consider it a failure to the extent that it wasn't of my doing. But that was the time when you said, "Oh, there's something big that happens that you're going to close your doors." That's the closest I ever got to actually being afraid of actually closing my doors. I was very close, very close.
Wow. So during that time, like going from 30 employees down to 5 employees, like there's definitely some level of fear there. And so you said that you were already of like an extreme business mindset, like on vacation and client calls and you're flying out there and just so business oriented at this time. During that time when your business was like kind of on the line, were you just working harder? Like, were you just putting in an extra 10 hours a week or like?
No, we just didn't have the work. We didn't have the work. Like my biggest clients, like you have to understand in construction and engineering, when the economy goes down, that's the first, those are the first industries that are hit because the money's not in the system. All these bank failures that were going on in 2010, 2007, 2008, nobody was lending because we depended a lot on construction, that people were building new stuff. So nobody was building. So it's just a matter of me just hoping and keeping people. And people would just show up and they were there for 8 hours a day, maybe working 2 or 3 hours. It was my wishful thinking that somehow, some way it was going to turn around. Thank God it did. Eventually, I held out for a long time. I lost a lot of money. And I think I was lucky in the sense that if the turnaround didn't happen, if the turnaround happened, was protracted another year, yeah, I would have gone out of business because I was just holding out hope. And that maybe was one mistake. I should have gotten rid of certain people and just maybe been myself, or maybe closed the company down. You know, that
and then reopened it back.
And then reopened it back when things got better. But I was just so, you know, concentrated on keeping my business open, because to me it was going to be a personal failure. It was going to be a big psychological hit to me if you know, I felt like a failure that was going to close my business.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. And so you've done the same business all the way up until now. So 23 years now, mm-hmm. practically.
Construction and engineering. I've been doing construction since 89. When I was studying in college, I went to work part-time for construction, and I started in 91 with Turner Construction. So, yes, 30 since 89. Yeah, 20, 30 something years, yeah.
Wow, that's crazy. Like, you wouldn't be able to do that unless you had a passion for it. Like, that's where it comes back to, like, 100%. What you're saying. Like, you can't put in that many years into something unless the passion's there.
There's lots of people in that business that have been doing it for a long time, because like I said, you know, this type of business values experience. The good contractors have a lot of experience. So people who tend to have 10 years, 15 years into the business, You have to capitalize on that experience. Even if you hate what you're doing, there's a lot of people in construction that absolutely hate construction, but, and they're making good money, but they're not going to like, oh, I'm going to go be a masseuse. Start from ground zero again. You know, just, you have to capitalize on that experience. But going back to the lucky part. Yeah. I feel lucky that yes, I maintain that same passion for so many years of doing the same thing.
Wow. So looking and projecting out for the next 5 years, you're talking about how, well, we're working on helping you build your brand. You actually hired an in-house social media person, which is really cool. Like, what is it for you in terms of, I know you said a component of helping people. That's also why you wrote a book. You're not even making any money from it, donate it all. And so is that the component of building your brand is just the aspect of wanting to help people?
Yes, it's helping people because I have a passion for that, but it's also about making money, right? Because, you know, some people, they buy real estate and they just lay back on their chairs and the money just comes in because people are paying their rents. And, you know, you want to, it doesn't matter what business you're in, you want to be able to work the least amount and make the biggest impact as far as making money. Everybody wants to do that. Unless you're a masochist, right? So I'm at the point right now where I have all this experience that is valuable experience. You can talk to me about anything about construction and engineering, and I'm like a freaking encyclopedia at a world-class level. And I said to myself, you know, now that I've written this book and I'm helping these people, why not establish a brand? And in establishing that brand, be able to do like the landlord. Okay, I've got my brand out there. You know, I'm going to sell my books, or maybe I can have speaking engagements where, you know, I can make money doing that and not necessarily be, you know, doing construction work, or because I've got my construction people, you know, doing construction. That's it's a dangerous business to be in. You know, it's a lot of lawsuits and, you know, those people that are doing construction, that know about construction a little bit, know exactly what I'm talking about. It's a very backstabbing type of industry.
Well, I want to go into some spitfire questions about specifically more about your business in terms of the real estate side of things. And so these are going to be like kind of quick questions, but and probably going to be cut up into like short form content. But one is, it's a scenario. So we have basically someone who's a single family and they're looking to renovate their home to increase the value of their home the most. And they're looking to renovate one or either two rooms of their entire house. What would those rooms be and why?
As a former real estate investor and flipper, hands down, first, kitchen, and second, bathrooms. Kitchens and bathrooms. Why? You might ask, why kitchens? Because most of the time, it's the women that make the decision, hey, let's buy this house, or say, we ain't buying this house. And the answer is no, and we're not doing it because the kitchen either looks like crap or whatever. But if you fix up your kitchen and you invest in a good kitchen, you'll get that money back, because if you're a flipper, if you flip your if you're doing in that flipping industry, you're going to get that money, because a nice, good looking, clean, modern kitchen, that is your best investment. If you are a person, like you said, that's living in the house currently and you're not looking to flip it, again, it's an investment, because one day you might want to leave this house to your kids. One day you might want to sell it, and you're investing in the house. You're investing in keeping your wife happy, because now she's got a nice kitchen. She's got a nice kitchen. She's going to be making good meals for you, right? So it's an investment. So it's different as if you were saying, I'm going to invest in going from a shingle roof to a barrel tile roofs. That's going to be a big investment, but that's not going to make the wife necessarily more happy, or it's not going to, you know, maybe increase the value of your home as maybe that you want it to. So hands down, kitchen.
That gets into the second situation, though, about the roofs, is if someone was renovating their house, what would be one thing that they should 1,000% stay away from, like be the last thing that they should ever renovate?
There's renovations, and this goes back to a basic concept in real estate, where if you have a house like this, for example, this house is probably, let's say it's a $3 million house. It's a very nice neighborhood, and all the houses around it are $3 million mansions. You might want to put, I'm exaggerating, you might want to put gold-plated faucet handles, right?
Yeah.
And there might be some people that come here and see the house if you want to sell it. And say, oh, this got gold-plated toilets, like Trump. It's got, you know, gold-plated this, and it's got these weird things. You could get some of that value back just because of the neighborhood that you live in.
Because of the little accents and...
No. It's not because of the accent. It's because that your investment, let's say you spend $10,000 in putting in a gold toilet and gold faucets and everything in your house. When you want to sell the house, you're going to have rich people coming in here, and they might like the fact that, you know, there's all this gold-plated stuff. So instead of this house being sold for $3 million, you spent $50,000 in all these fixtures, and then you can sell the house for $3,050,000. Now, keep that in your mind. Now you're going to go to a house, a middle-class neighborhood, right? Where the house doesn't sell for $3 million. It sells for $200,000. And I'm exaggerating, of course, but yeah. Let's say that you're going to put that same toilet inside of $50,000 into that house on gold fixtures and a gold toilet. Do you think a person is then he's going to sell the house and he's going to not sell it for $200,000? He wants to sell it for $200,000 plus the investment of $50,000. Do you think anybody's going to buy the house for $250,000?
No.
So when you ask the question about you know, what are those things that you can invest in, the first thing you have to know is what can support what things that I can do to the house that will support the investment that you know, the property value will grow. Like this place, if you put a swimming pool in here, oh, it'll increase the value. But if you live in a very poor neighborhood, putting a swimming pool is not priority. It's not something that, you know, you're not going to get your money back necessarily. And this is one of the things when I go to big condos. I just had a meeting last week with a huge condo, and they wanted to see if they had some repairs that they wanted to do. And I said, you guys should definitely look at replacing all of your windows, because the windows are 40 years old. They're not hurricane proof, right? And it's going to cost you about $6 million to change all these windows to hurricane glass. To, you know, because you've been to Miami.
Yeah,
you know some of these condos.
Yeah.
But this condo is right on the beach, right next to the Westin Diplomat in Hollywood. And they still have these old raggedy-ass windows. And I told them, if you put $6 million into this building, the value of each one of these units is going to go up. The same amount of that investment that you put in, you're going to get it back just because you're on the beach. People are paying millions and millions of dollars for condos, but they see these raggedy-ass windows. They're not going to want to invest that much. They'll go to another building that they feel safe in. So if you ask me, it depends on the property. It depends on how much it can absorb that investment. Like in a poor house, in a house that is in the $200,000, you know, neighborhood, let's think about it. Maybe putting in some really nice tile in the kitchen, or maybe doing a little bit of renovation in your kitchen. You don't have to go and like destroy the entire kitchen, because a good kitchen renovation will cost you $50,000, $60,000, $70,000. But doing certain things like laminating the cabinet fronts, like you're going to have old ass cabinets, but if you laminate them with PVC, there's people that go out, they do it for really cheap. They make the cabinets look new. You know, that's another investment. But if you did that, laminating cabinets here in this house, a $3 million house, nobody would buy it. This is a cheap ass motherfucker. He's got laminated cabinets here. Let's get out.
Yeah, it's contextual in terms of like where it's the location of it.
Absolutely.
Is based off of it.
Absolutely.
If someone is another situation, if somebody's like determining whether it would be more worthwhile, they just purchased a property and it's super run down, and they're determining whether it would be better to completely gut the place and do a full reno inside, or destroy the place and build it from the ground up. What is the framework that somebody goes through, like an investor or a flipper goes through to like making that decision?
100% numbers. The numbers talk, and when they talk, the numbers don't lie. Okay, you have a lot of, like, I've been an investor, and it's a very dirty business because there's a lot of shady things going on. But the numbers are your friend, and the numbers will not let you down, and the numbers will not lie to you. If you have a house, okay, the house has to be in really, really bad shape structurally. It's probably got like a sinkhole underneath to raise it and put a new house in there, unless that neighborhood supports it. There are neighborhoods in Florida where people just tear down the house, they build these big mansions, and they make bank. But it's because the numbers tell them that people are willing to pay millions of dollars to buy these big, some people call them mech mansions, in the middle of, like, they have small houses, big yeah. mansion, because they have an intercoastal in the back. Uh-huh. So again, it goes back to the numbers. And me being a contractor and an engineer, I am a big numbers guy. And if not only a numbers guy, but a person who knows about real estates and values and appraisals. So you basically have to do your homework. Like if this house is going to cost me $200,000, and it's really messed up, and if I fix it up and spend $100,000, I can sell it for $400,000. So I just made, you know, if that turns out, I can make $100,000. Okay, easy $100,000. However, if you have that same house, again, context is neighborhood. If you have that same house that's in on the intercoastal, do you think that if I can demo the house, build a Mac mansion up, I can buy the house for $200,000, I can build the back mansion for $1 million, assuming I can get the loan or have the money, and then I can sell it for $2 million, I can put $600,000 into my pocket, you know, after closing costs and all that other stuff. And after waiting for a year, or more than a year, to build the house, you have, you know, costs like bank loans and things like that. You know, you're gonna have to wait. A flip is fast, but if you're gonna build a house, you've gotta wait. So if you're the kind of person that does the numbers and is willing to take the risk and wait for that income, then yeah. But you have to make that decision. The numbers talk.
And talking about where the real estate is like located and stuff, like we're in Puerto Rico right now. Like, you were born in Puerto Rico. I think Puerto Rico is one of the only places I've ever been, and I think that you could probably give me some answers to this, of where you go to the beachfront and you see condominium, rundown house. Condominium, rundown condominium that nobody lives in. What's the reason why there's like houses right on the beachfront that like nobody even lives in, or like run down, like just buildings, massive buildings in perfect locations?
I have a theory. I have a theory because I see those buildings too. Yeah. And I am, oh my God, I can buy this building. Yeah. But when you look into these things, my girlfriend probably knows better than me, maybe knows other answers, but because I've been around enough to listen to the stories, the laws in Puerto Rico that have to do with when somebody dies and people get, you know, certain, you know, like if I die, my daughter can get my property, you know, that those are strict laws. But if you have a property in Puerto Rico, the laws aren't that simple. When you have a fight with people who are the heirs, it becomes very complicated. And sometimes these things go on for many years, and sometimes people just give up on it. They say, I'm not going to fight it. And they just, and that happened to me a while like 20 years ago with my aunt and uncle. They died. They didn't want to leave anything written for their son. And Now they have squatters living in their house and nobody can get rid of them.
No.
Because again, they've been living there for 20 years, these squatters, and they think that the house is theirs and they're living there for free. And it's a legal complication where you can't, it's just better to just say, oh, you know what? Forget it. I'm just going to leave the house. What do you think?
Well, the law is like if you live here in this abandoned house for 10 years, then nobody comes and claims it, then it's yours.
No way.
If you pay the taxes, yes. If you pay the that's true. If you see an abandoned house and you live in it and you pay the property taxes for 10 years, they deed the house to you. And there's been people that have done that. I mean, it's crazy. But if after nine years, 11 months, the guy comes back and says, "Hey, that's my house. Get out of here." Then
that's all those crazy.
And you're done. But I have heard of people just getting in there and squatting for 10 years. And
that is nuts.
But that's one of the things that because you have so much. There's a lot of beautiful property here. A lot
beautiful
of beachfront property. And me as a contractor and engineer, I see a house that's like half falling apart. And what I see is something beautiful. And it's sometimes frustrating. I say, man, it's very difficult to get into the legal aspects of it. And, you know, just because of the way that the legal structure is here in Puerto Rico, it's very different than the States. Yeah, some people just give up.
Nuts. Nuts. Well, Greg, we're going on over an hour. This is awesome. It, with closing things up, with talking to the audience and like, you're a father of two daughters. And so just from like this brief conversation, I can assume that you've given absolutely amazing advice to your daughters and like they seem successful in your eyes. And so what is some of like the best repetitive advice that you've consistently given to your daughters over like their childhood growing up and their adulthood years?
Oh my God. Have you ever thought of being an interviewer, like a professional interviewer? Like you could be like an Oprah. They ask some good questions. Oh my God. Look, I'll tell you from the get-go, I feel a lot of times I have this guilty feeling, like I was saying before, that I see sometimes pictures of me and my daughters when they were little and stuff. And I always have this thing, oh, I should have been for them more, you know, been there for them, you know, more. But, you know, and everybody tells me, like my parents tell me, you were a good father. Yeah, you had your things, your crazy things going on, but you were there for them. You provided for them. And, you know, but I would say, because, you know, I can give all sorts of advice and everything, but, you know, this is the High Key podcast, and it's geared more towards, you know, entrepreneurship and things of that sort. I've always brought my daughters up to be independent. Like, for example, when they were little, and it's just one example of many, and my daughter would say, "Dad, I want to go to the bathroom." I said, "Okay, you see that door over there? That's the bathroom. Like, I'll watch you, just go." "No, I don't want to." "Well, you're gonna pee on yourself on your chair. Like, go. And the thing is that some people might see me and it might hear this and say, "Oh, he's cruel." It's just, no. I firmly believe that if you teach your children to be independent, you teach them not to be afraid. And of course, they're still children, but you're still keeping an eye on them. But that flexes their muscle as far as having that independence, and independence leads to independence of thought. And I think that that's like the most important thing that you can give your kid, because there's a lot of people out there who are helicopter parents. You know, when I grew up, all the kids were out in the street, and, you know, we didn't have, you know, we never wore seatbelts in our cars.
Yeah.
We never put on these, you know, I'm going to go roller skating. Okay, go knock yourself out. We never put helmets on or anything. It was a different mentality. Now it's like helicopter parents. Everybody's like, "Oh, am I worried?" And, "Oh, don't say bad words in front of them." And I think that that's doing a disservice. And I can have a psychologist stand in front of me right now and say, "Greg, you're so mistaken." He'll have his points. I'll have my points. I'm just talking about experience, that if you, in your own way, you can protect your child's, not just protect your child, you can protect your child's future by instilling in them a sense of independence and not be such a freaking, you know, helicopter parents. I think that would go a long way, because when you instill that in a child, that feeling that you engender in them grows at a geometric rate. Because what's one step here can turn into 10 things that they can do in the future, in a year, in 10 years. In high school, they can be a leader in their high school and be like the class president because they have that in them. If you're the class president, all the class presidents that I know in the past, they're all successful people, you know? So that very small seed that you put into your child's heart and to their mind, it's just, it's incalculable.
Yeah, the independence, that's amazing. What my dad always used to do with us is anything that we wanted that wasn't a necessity, anything that we wanted, like a new bike, a car when we got up, or a phone or social media, he's like, okay, well, get a job and pay for it. And I think that's a level of independence. And it taught me to like value every single thing that I had. And when it was my money on the line being spent, I didn't spend it on stupid things. And so I always thought that was cool.
That's great. That's your dad. I mean, yeah. I'm older and I like to spoil my daughters, and anything they ask me, I always give it to them, whatever. But now they're all grown, you know, so it's like a different dynamic. But yeah, God bless your father, man. That's great. That's great.
Well, I appreciate it, Greg. Anybody listening right now, where would be the best place that you'd want to send them? To your Instagram?
Right now, I'm developing my Instagram. I'm developing my articles. I seldom go to Instagram just to see my girlfriend's stuff. On Facebook. I have a Facebook. Okay, yeah, Facebook.
is your Facebook your name, Greg Batista?
Yeah, it's Greg Batista, but I've got a bunch of like funny, stupid videos, things that I'll tell you later. Right now, but if you do want to contact me, whatever, then you know, you can just go to my website. My website has links to all my social media and, you know, LinkedIn and a bunch of videos that I've done. But the website is www.askgbatista.com.
Awesome. Dude, it's been amazing. I hope on social media that I see you posting content like this. I think that you can bring an absolute ton of value to, like, not just people specifically in the real estate space, and really any single person, like so much knowledge, so much wisdom. So
I appreciate that. Yeah. I appreciate you saying that.
Thanks for being on the show, Greg. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Take care.